This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/in touch. Good evening. Tonight, I think this might be a first for In Touch. We're starting the programme in a kitchen. I'll tell you who's in a moment, because we're keeping our promise made last week to relate fitness for visually impaired people to food. We'll be looking at ingredients and methods which won't break the bank, aren't too complicated, and are safe as well. Also, later in the programme, why demand for hospital eye services is in crisis and what it's going to take to tackle it. But first, let's get back to the kitchen, which belongs to Richard Lane, whose Can't See Will Cook series on In Touch a few years ago. Some of you may well remember. The idea of that was to show that you could be safe and imaginative in your cooking, and that not everything had to come out of a tin or a microwave. So it was to Richard we returned this time to look at food and fitness. So Richard, standing by the hob as you are, first of all, just describe what your attitude to all this is.
A lot of common sense, I think. And also brilliant that In Touch is now you're linking fitness with food, because the two are obviously very closely related.
I think you heard the programme we did last week. That looked at fitness, physical fitness.
It was great to hear you being put through your paces by Jane Taylor. My own take on fitness, a bit like food, really. I don't try not to overdo it, but try and certainly keep active. I think it's all really, really important. And I don't do exercise to offset any unhealthy eating that I do. I think that's a bad way of looking at it. I see the two as complementary.
So this isn't all too theoretical. You've related a lot of your ideas to one particular recipe this week, haven't you?
Well, I think it's carrying on from what we did with Can't See Will Cook a few years ago. The spirit there was cook creatively, use lovely ingredients, don't make it too complicated, and also I really don't want to be pious about what we should or should not be eating. Food is a great pleasure in life, and I hope many people listening will agree with that. So in the recipe today, it's a very simple, sorry if it sounds a bit boring, and apologies for vegetarians. I do love vegetarian food, but we're not vegetarian tonight. We're having a very simple chicken and bacon casserole with some steamed veg.
That sounds great to me, because I love the idea of both chicken and bacon, but it doesn't sound massively healthy.
It's not unhealthy, because again we're using bacon, which has got a little bit of fat on it, but we'll use the fat to help cook the chicken. But the chicken is very lean, the vegetables are all fresh and are going to be steamed. Steaming veg is a wonderful way of preserving their goodness, and we're going to have it with a little bit of wild rice as well. So that's a well balanced meal.
So just tell us how you start off.
I'm going to first off chop up the bacon, including the fat of the bacon. I'm not going to add any oil. I want to use the natural fat within the ingredients of this recipe. So by cooking off the bacon and then removing it from the pan with a slotted spoon, easy to do. Then brown off the chicken very quickly, which I've just rolled in a little bit of flour. That will help give the casserole a bit of thickness later on. Then it'll be just the usual thing, chop up some onion, some veg, some mushrooms, and then I'm going to add in some stock. We'll just let the whole thing simmer for 45 minutes. Then we'll steam the veg. I want to show you the vegetable steamer, because to me that's a revelation in terms of ease of cooking.
And the one thing I remember about you is that you're big on organisation, aren't you?
I absolutely swear by it, and I'm sure other visually impaired people do, because if you spend the time preparing it, it takes the stress out of cooking. And there's nothing worse, particularly when you can't see and you've got a hot stove going on, if you're getting stressed about what you're doing. It's a slippery slope, so preparation is everything. We start with the good old chef's pan and the bacon, which I've cut up into sort of 1-inch squares with its fat on, because we're using the fat, remember, as the base for the dish. And it's just going to be dry fried in the chef's pan. Unmistakable sound and smell of frying bacon.
Does it bother you at all, the stove? I mean, we're talking about heat, we're talking about fat.
No, you've got to be careful, but I think having the right equipment is important. And this panel I keep going on about, because it's got a wide diameter and it's quite deep at the sides, it covers the gas ring, so you've got no gas licking around the edge of the pan. You can't burn yourself. And as I'm doing now, to get the bacon out, I'm not taking the bacon out with the gas still on, I've turned it off. Still cooking on its own for a bit. I'll whip the bacon out, put the chicken in, and then turn it on again. So we'll just do that now.
Okay. What about speed of getting things done, Richard? Because you obviously are careful. I mean, would your wife cook something quicker than you?
Probably. She does everything quicker than me. But isn't that part of being blind? Everything takes a bit longer, right. Which I think a lot of the time, which is why preparation is key.
And given that we're talking about fitness, are you a calorie counter?
No, I don't count calories. I just think about what I eat, and I eat sensibly. And a lot of blind people, I know, love food because it's a great comfort. You know, if you've got a sense that, like, sight that's suddenly gone, if you can enjoy food, the taste and textures and flavours in food, it can be a very rewarding thing to do. So I would hate to send out a message to visually impaired people that food is something that we shouldn't be getting involved in. I really think we should. It's just about managing it and obviously thinking about exercise as well.
So what's the next step?
Right. So next step will be just fried off the bacon. One day we'll be able to smell the radio. It will be so good. And we're now going to just fry off the chicken. And I'm just going to brown the chicken off for a minute or so.
Some people will be listening to this and will have maybe stopped doing quite a lot of these kind of things. You know, will be almost exclusively using the microwave or not cooking. How would you encourage them to do what you're doing now?
Probably, for starters, do it with a friend who can see what they're doing. Confidence is very important. And the last thing you want is a setback early on. You'll never cook again. Build up your skills and then have a go yourself.
I mean, for people who are newly blind, pouring milk on cornflakes is bad enough.
Yeah.
Because the first thing you do, it goes over the edge.
Right, I've lost my spoon again.
It's good to know that someone as organised as you actually does lose things. I must say, it's quite reassuring.
Oh, absolutely.
I do it so often, I realise how easy it is. You would think, wouldn't you, something as central to what you're doing as that, you wouldn't forget where you put it, but
it's
I do all the time.
It's so maddening, isn't it? So maddening. So this is just a very quick browning off of the chicken. And now, what do I do when I want to transfer the meat? Turn it off.
That's your mantra, isn't it, really? Turn it off.
If in doubt, turn it off. There we go. I'm now putting the chicken in a very deep-sided bowl where the bacon resides. So the chicken is now sitting out of the pan on top of the bacon. They're chatting to each other. Good, so that's the meat done, which is now out of the pan. And I'm now going to chop an onion. I've already started chopping it to save time because we're going to have a good old onion base. You can hear me and chopping it. No, not my fingers.
Well, I was going to say, where are your fingers while you're doing this?
Well, they're close, but I curl your top part of your finger in. So if your knife did slip, it might get your nail, but it wouldn't get the fleshy part of your finger. That is a standard chef's trick, and it does work. Just chopping up a leek, mushrooms. And again, sounds obvious, cooking blind without any useful sight at all. It's totally hands-on experience. Of course, I've washed my hands, but I'm getting totally involved here, feeling the food.
You were able to see, and then you began to cook blind. Did you find quite quickly that you'd stick your hands in everything, that you had to do that, really?
You have to, absolutely. If you've got no functional vision at all, then your hands do everything. Let's get the veg on. Back on with the gas. I'm actually going to put the onion in first. One leek and about 10 button mushrooms just sliced. And while that's just sort of having a little cook, perhaps we could talk about stock. I'm doing the ultimate cheat, but it's great, it works. It's 1 teaspoon of vegetable bouillon powder. So that's like a vegetable stock powder. I think they call it Swiss vegetable bouillon, don't they? You get it in most supermarkets. 1 teaspoon in a coffee mug. There it is. And then to the right of the stove, my blind kettle. My blind kettle is the kettle that's already calibrated to automatically pour just under a cup full of boiling water. No fiddly pouring of boiling water out of kettles, spilling it everywhere, scalding yourself. You can hear the kettle over on the right.
So you just picked that up in your local high street?
Yep, about £30. And it's got a little nozzle on the top, so you can alter the amount of water that comes out. Use it all the time. Every day, at least 5 times a day.
Right.
No spilling, no scalding. About 50 stirs. So I've now got a mug full of vegetable stock. Smell that, Peter?
Oh, that's lovely.
Lovely smell?
Mm.
So here we go. You can hear the veggies are in there. The meat is still out at this point. The veggies are in, but they're nicely sautéed. In she goes with the whole stock, just pouring it into the pan. So that stock is in there, and that's beginning to reduce a little bit. This is where we add the meat back in. So I'm holding a high-sided hot, and I'm now just going to gently add the meat. But now you reach this lovely point where everything starts calming down. I would add a bit of black pepper. I would give it a bit of black pepper.
Right, well, while there's a bit of a lull in proceedings and there's some simmering going on, perhaps this is the moment to move on to our other item this week. Two developments which we ought to be able to celebrate are apparently creating a crisis in the treatment of eye disease. One of those developments is that more and more of us are living longer, long enough to develop a range of eye conditions. The other, that over the past few years, huge strides have been made in treating such diseases. But the result is an enormous demand on hospital and community services, which is why a summit has been taking place today to look for ways to tackle the problem. Well, I've been talking to Chris McGachie. He represents High Street optometrists, who are very much involved in this summit. He belongs to the local optical committee support unit. I asked him first to explain how big this crisis was.
Well, the Royal College admitted that the service was at bursting point, and obviously with an ageing population, elderly people tend to suffer more from eyesight problems. And 10% of all outpatient appointments are now for eyes, making it the second biggest outpatient group in the NHS. The call on appointments for eye-related services in the NHS has gone up by 30% in the last 5 years. There are 1.7 million new patients every year, and there are 5.2 million follow-up appointments every year. So the Royal College of Ophthalmologists has acknowledged that this can't go on in terms of the current capacity and demand, and that we need to think about doing things differently.
We have touched on this before, the situation of people with macular disease, for example, who are having to wait for key injections. And I'm wondering what's really being suggested at this summit, which we've not seen before?
Well, I think we're looking at redesigning services to deal with the problems as they are at the moment. So we want to stop people having to go to a hospital for appointments where that's unnecessary. In the majority of cataract operations, most are unproblematic, so there's no real need to go back to an ophthalmologist after the surgery. Much of the low-risk monitoring for both cataract and glaucoma can be done in the community at the optical practice. The fact is that optometrists are highly skilled medical professionals. They're all registered with the General Optical Council. It really is a case of looking at, from a practical and logistical point of view, how can we make these services so that the patient gets a timely and a convenient appointment in a place that suits them, so that the hospitalised service can be left to go on to sort out the backlog and to deal with the most urgent cases so that people don't suffer avoidable sight loss.
Because at the moment, what tends to happen if somebody really feels they've got an eye problem is either they go to their GP thinking that they'll get a referral, or if something happens suddenly, they'll go to A&E. How do you change the culture in a way if you're thinking that somebody like an optometrist is in a better position to make a judgment?
Well, that's true. That is what happens at the moment. And, you know, Alistair Butt, the health minister, said recently to an optical sector gathering that he thought one of the problems was that GPs were seen as the sort of first point of call on every ailment regardless. And I think what we'd like to see is to see optical practices become the front door to the NHS. We need to mainstream this as an idea so that optometrists become the first port of call for eye health, GPs of the eyes, if you like. Most optical practices are on the high street. They're very convenient. They offer extended opening hours and weekend opening hours for appointments.
So probably what it needs is more publicity to say this is the place to go.
And more commissioning of services, yeah.
Isn't there a danger that you're just, as it were, transferring the demand? Have you actually got, for example, the optometrists to cope with this problem?
There are 12,000 optometrists. There are 6,000 high street practices. I think the argument that the optical sector is making is that if we can reduce the demand, both by having minor eye conditions and by having some of this low-risk monitoring within the community, we can allow ophthalmology to deal with the most urgent and complex cases. That and the end up will reduce avoidable sight loss.
Chris McGachie, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Chris McGachie, who represents High Street Optometrists. Well, We're in Richard Lane's kitchen today. There's a delicious smell emanating from his bacon and chicken casserole. We're talking about fitness and food with Richard. Richard, what next?
Well, I'm just quietly simmering over here, and the casserole is bubbling away very gently. Stage two, and it's very simple, stage two, are the veg and the rice.
And this is where you get very excited about your steamer, isn't
it? Well, I mean, there's a limit to how excited you can get about a vegetable steamer, but it is actually relatively exciting. It was a revelation to me. I think I always boiled veg, chucked it in pans, maybe poured water from my kettle dangerously. Of course, we don't do that now with the blind kettle that I showed you earlier. And I've been warming water up while you've been doing the other part of the programme. There are two segments of the steamer. I'm just using one of them. Imagine a wedding cake, just want another layer of the wedding cake. Here it is. And it's got holes in the bottom, obviously, because yeah. It's going to take the steam from the bottom bit. It's got a good, simple top, because you've obviously got to seal it in, because you don't want the steam to get out.
The interesting thing about what you've mentioned here, the gadgets, none of these have been made specifically with visually impaired people in mind, have they?
No. Absolutely ordinary mainstream stuff. There are just some things that just make perfect sense if you've got a sight difficulty. Oh, I've totally forgot to do something. Forgot to put the rice in.
The rice.
Ah, not to worry. Hold that. What do you think that is? What does it feel like?
Well, it's got a handle on. It's a sort of cup, really.
Yes.
Yeah. It's metal.
Yeah. Feels like a mini saucepan, doesn't it, with its handle?
It does.
But of course, it's the American cup system. Get your bag of rice.
Yeah, you've filled it right up to the top, Richard.
Yeah, well, I know what an appetite you've got. Oh, and I've spilt some as
I'm
well.
Trying to... You have spilt a little bit there.
Yeah.
In the real world, how long would this take you to do?
The whole thing in an hour and a half. You're thinking, well, hang on, who's got an hour and a half to cook a meal? But remember, this could do 2-3 meals.
Well, I know how some people actually hate hearing people eating and saying how wonderful it is, and I've eaten your food, so I know it's going to be wonderful, so we won't do that. But Richard Lane, thank you very much indeed. If people have their own suggestions about any of the aspects of this we've been talking about, you can call our action line on 0800 044 044 for 24 hours after the programme. You can email intouch@bbc.co.uk, or if you're able to go online, you can find out more about this and you can download tonight's and future programmes. From Richard Lane's kitchen, Richard, thank you very much indeed. I'm Peter White, and this was produced by Siobhan Tye.
There is one talking gadget which I would like to just show you before you leave. My French lady should explain to listeners what this means. As I said earlier, I'm really not obsessive about counting and measuring and all the rest of it. But body weight, it is important to it. And obviously that means if you're visually impaired, you need some scales that are going to tell you what to do. So my scales are great because they, A, tell me my weight, and B, give me a bit of French practice at the same time. It's in French because... Well, I can't remember why it's in French. I pressed a button and it went into French.
And I can't get it
back into English. And I'm worried that if I fiddle with the button, I might end up with it in Dutch. And I brought them downstairs from the bathroom down here into the kitchen. So I thought we'd pop you on the scales, Pete, before you go.
Certainly not. I think we should pop you on the scales. These are yours, not mine.
Right. See what she says.
Okay.
I would like to emphasise that I'm going to be over my little limit here because I'm fully clothed and I'm not taking my clothes off in front of Peter and Siobhan just so I can be under my little limit that I like to be under.
Okay, let's hear her in action then.
Ah, drat! She said, bonjour, good day, votre pesée, your weight, and then she said, 80.4 kilograms, which is annoying because I like to try and keep under 80. In old money, it would be about 12 and a half stone.
Oh, right. I'm not getting on there.